Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bad Internet Fans Podcast.
We are live.
We got Ivan. We got David. We got the internets. We are good to go. This is episode...
A really dark room. Time to adjust my lamp a little bit here.
I thought you were just getting romantic.
Yeah, I mean, we could be a little cozy.
Yeah, mood lighting. We're going to do episode 22, which is going to be the New Rules Deep Dive. Hey, hobby homies.
And it's a 2-for-1.
2-for-1. So you pay $0 and you get 2.
Which is, I guess it's 1.5-for-1 because Rogue Camera is not that new. It's new. Well, it's newish. It seems like a lot of people picked it up recently.
I feel like it's been around forever, but also it's kind of new because I don't actually know how it works.
Well, that is actually true because it was around forever and then it's developed a lot lately. So, but now I'm starting to see people say that they're pinning armies specifically for that or buying stuff for it. So I think we have arrived. Nice. That's a good time to basically say it's new. Oh, we got Jason in the
Okay. So we got Fox and we got Jason. Nice.
Yeah. Sure, that's all the most important people.
Yeah. I mean, all we need is ham butt now to
Torben spice up
with those good British spices.
Just keep the sprouts away before somebody gets hurt.
Yeah. Before we begin talking about the games, do you have any life stuff to bring up? Hobby things?
No, I basically just been working on Project 1 that I can't tell anybody about, and Project 2 that I can't tell anybody about.
Yeah, a lot of hobby streams have this introduction where people talk about what they've been working on and this and that, but you're always so secretive. We never know what Ivan's doing.
No, well, the problem is that I have basically not had time and energy to do any hobbying. I've just been reading books and working and watching hockey. So,
ooh, hockey. Not,
nice. Yeah. Swedish women's hockey, actually.
Nice.
So SDHL. Yeah, it's all on YouTube now. So you can just watch for free. You have to watch it to Swedish though. So crazy. It's pretty good stuff. So if you're into, I was waiting for PWHL to start back up. But that's not until November. So, got into hockey last year. Now I'm fired up.
Nice. Yeah.
So, it's like somebody who becomes converts to become Catholic or something. They're always the most fired up that you'll ever meet.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the new converts are always eager to go.
So it's the same thing. So I'm super stoked about it. But it's one of those things where because I'm working a lot right now, which is good, but it means I have I need something that I can just unwind to. So that ended up being kind of the answer.
Do you find you can listen to sports like hockey or soccer and still work on writing rules?
No, not really. I end up, it's the same, I don't listen to podcasts when I work either, because either I will end up paying attention to it and then I realize I've been sitting there for 20 minutes not writing anything. Or if I'm deep in the zone and writing, I will just have heard nothing whatsoever. So I always listen to music. I will, if it's a day where there's a lot of games on, during the women's Euros, I would work for a while, then I would stop and watch for 20 minutes and pause it, and then I would go back to work for a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
It's that thing with the tomato timer. I forget what it's called, but there's this... It's like a
tomato?
It's a productivity YouTube dork thing. The dudes are optimizing their lives. But it's this thing where you set a timer and you work for 15 minutes. You're supposed to work real, real hard. And then you take a break for 10 minutes. And then you go back and work for 15 more minutes or whatever. So it's kind of like that, where I would just work for a while, then I would stop and watch 20 minutes of football, and then I would go back to work. So
nice.
So that works really. Yeah, I just can't listen to something that has meaning to it. I always just listen, the more gnarly, the better. Some super repetitive death metal and I'm in the zone. That's my vibe.
My neurodivergence says I need to do two unrelated things at the same time to be truly happy. So painting miniatures and playing The Sims, or when I'm at work, I'm working on bicycles and I'm listening to hobby podcasts.
I know for a lot of, when I was going to be a school teacher, they had sort of come around to accept that ADHD was a thing that exists. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was that sometimes it's actually not a bad thing to let kids draw or something or doodle, because then they can actually pay better attention in class.
Yeah.
As long as they're not drawing dicks or something.
Oh yeah, hopefully.
but basically you give them something they can kind of do on the side, and it'll help them focus by not focusing, I guess. I don't know how it works. I just know that's what the state of the art of science in like 2000 said.
Yeah. My daughter has that. In a previous school, she was in Spanish bilingual, and they let her draw. And they said eventually she just drew too much and she didn't really pay attention. She's too into her art.
But maybe that's how you find out that she's like actually supposed to be an artist or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, we switched tactics. Now she's in art school. So it's Arts Academy. So now it's all appropriate. She's on task.
But now, you know? So now she has to have like a lecture so that she can pay attention to the drawing.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So she has to speak out. For me, let's see, I'll just hold these dudes up. Working on some little miniatures for Rangers of Shadowdeep.
Hey, are they what, Frostgrave guys?
This one is a mixture of Warlord and Mantic.
Oh, okay.
Some, like gauntlets on a Celtic guy, and then gave him like a elf cloak from Warhammer. So he's pretty cool. And then so yeah, these like two are different... all like Frostgrave.
So that guy's like three different sets.
Yeah, exactly. He's my kit bash.
It is kind of awesome how many sets from different companies are like semi-compatible or even like fully compatible.
Yeah, I love it.
Like that used to not be the case, I feel.
In the case of the arms, like I just took regular Celtic arms that I chopped them off of the elbows and they stuck on the gauntlets from a demon set. So get like big demon gauntlets on.
Which
is pretty fun.
That's cool.
I grabbed the wrong dry brush, though, so I was going to like finish off with like some like light dry brush highlighting after doing some slap chop. But the one I grabbed, even though like I like brushed it off completely, it's still like oversaturated.
So,
I tried out some of this marine juice that I made from Slonic Sledgehammer recipe and kind of tied it all back together, but it's kind of like muddy looking now, unless you hold it in light and then they look, you know, pretty snappy. But
There's
if I just put it on my desk, it looks like a brown mud, so.
Yeah, it's like when people do like the non-metal metallics, and sometimes like when you see it in person, it kind of just doesn't look any different, but it looks great in photos for some reason.
So it's weird.
It's like Instagram, basically.
Yeah, the camera is really making him look way better than they do in real life. Which is fun.
I mean, some people kind of optimize their, you know, like if you're a guy who like paints for Instagram or something like that's your thing, then you almost like want to optimize your techniques for what works on camera versus what works in person.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's kind of a different, it just depends on like what you're actually trying to get out of.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm getting close to starting my 5 parsecs from home. That joint campaign that's running in the Nordic Weasel Games Discord right now. And by close, I mean, I'm just like, almost have set up a table, but I haven't quite yet.
That's getting pretty close.
It's getting there.
Dice could be rolling.
I know where the miniatures are, so I can bring them out.
That's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah, and I'm gonna run the second edition. So I reprinted out everything. I compiled all the like, expansions and stuff today. I'll attach them into PDFs, and it's amazing how they're like three times as thick as the actual rule book when it all stacked together.
That was a lot of stuff by the end of that.
It was a lot of stuff.
So yeah, it's sometimes when people ask like, oh, there was this thing. Do you still have that? Like, maybe that was a lot. Like there's a few things that, that went lost.
I bet Bill has them somewhere.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So do we want to start with the talk about Roguehammer?
Yeah. Do we need like a one-line intro first, or is that one of the questions?
Yeah, give us the elevator pitch, and then we'll go into the big fleshy AI questions.
About pies and all the goodies. Well, the elevator pitch is that Roguehammer is an alternate way to play everyone's favorite dark gothic sign. We mean Warhammer. But it's based on the Squadhammer engine, so kind of abstracted rules and unit-based. So units fire at each other instead of individual guys, and you don't have figure removal. It's also mostly based on Rogue Trader and Second Edition. And by mostly, I mean like 99%. And there's also some dumb bullshit I added to it. Like there's going to be a Star Wars army list and stuff like that, but they're not quite done yet. Okay. That's the elevator pitch. You want Stormtroopers plus Orcs versus Terran Ents and Doctor Who? That will be a thing.
And who could ask for more? Like, All right. So the deep dive questions. We'll start with the game's foundation and philosophy.
Ooh.
So our first question is, the rulebook states that Roguehammer is inspired by the original Gothic science fiction game rules and Oldhammer playstyle. Could you elaborate on what aspects of these games and that era you most wanted to capture?
Yeah. See, that's not a bad question. The robot is on it.
The robot's getting good.
Yeah. So Oldhammer is one of those things that, like, everyone knows what it means, but if you have to pin them down, it's a little trickier. It kind of just, for 40K, it kind of mostly means Rogue Trader in second edition. But I think it also gets associated with this, like, more, like, fun era. Like, it's definitely not, like, tournament play. It's setting up a, like, I pick my guys, and you pick your guys, and maybe we come up with a little scenario or something, or maybe we just do a battle. But it's kind of meant to be a little more chill, you know, like, you're kind of hoping for, like, weird stuff to happen and have a laugh about it, you know. So it's kind of a low-key, like, beer and pretzels approach to the game. And I think it's also about, like, embracing, like, some of the weirder stuff of those settings, as opposed to trying to have everything, like, very homogenized stuff. At least to me, that's what Oldhammer kind of means. That's kind of I think for a lot of people, too, it's, like, a little bit of nostalgia. It's, like, the game as it was when you started playing for a lot of people. So it's capturing, like, the way that you played those games back then, but with the benefit of, like, some experience.
Okay. The next question will be, you mentioned that the game focuses on large-scale effect, not point-by-point detail. Mm-hmm. Does this philosophy influence the core mechanics, like the unit-based combat system and the simplified weapon details?
Yeah, it does. So this is where the squad hammer thing comes in. So in 40K, when a squad of Space Marines shoots into the squad, you roll, you know, to hit for each of your dudes, and then you roll armor saves and so on, and you remove, like, individual guys. So everything is very, like, specific. Each guy has his own weapon that has a specific range, strength, and armor penetration, all that stuff. Squad Hammer is all unit-based, so when a squad of Space Marines, or Star Knights, as they are, shoots at another squad, you make a single roll to hit, which sort of captures, like, all the firepower of the squad. So in Squad Hammer, in Rogue Hammer, it doesn't really matter if, like, that guy is throwing a grenade and those two guys are shooting and that guy is moving and shooting. Like, you just get one roll that encompasses, like, all the firepower of the squad. And if they hit, they do damage. The second part of the abstraction is that instead of removing guys and then making morale checks, you just take damage. So a squad might have 9 hit points and you do 1d6 damage if you hit. So if a squad loses hit points, it might be because they have had a bunch of dudes die, or it might be because their morale is real bad now, or it might be a bit of both. Maybe one of their dudes got wounded and the squad is kind of pinned down. So by kind of abstracting out to that level, you can kind of have, like, a bunch of things happen. So, like, if I shoot at a squad and they lose some hit points and then I charge them and kill them, you know, that in the fiction, obviously what happened is that I suppressed them with, like, with one squad, and then we ran over and, like, chopped them up with the axes. Yeah, that's very Warhammer. You know, it can be, so you're kind of free to, like, because damage and morale and other discomfort is all, like, summarized in this, like, unit state of hit points, instead of having a bunch of different status effects. It sort of works. So the squad is, instead of a squad being broken and you can't use it, there's low on hit points. You have to be kind of careful with them, because if they take another hit, they're probably gone. But you can rally them for a couple of turns. So it kind of captures the same vibe as, you know, your squad breaks in Warhammer and they have to hang out for a couple of turns before you successfully rally them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just all mushed together in basically the hit roll and then the hit point score.
Okay. Yeah, those are the good old days when your units just didn't disappear off the table forever.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next question will be, the game is powered by the Squad Hammer engine. For those unfamiliar, what are the key principles of this engine, and how has Roguehammer evolved or deviated from its parent system?
Yeah, so we already talked about hit points and, like, unit-based shooting. So the, like, one thing left that is unique is how activations work, which is when it's your turn. So in Squad Hammer, you roll a die, and that's how many units you get to go. Basically, anyone who doesn't get to go is, like, heads down, minding their own business, they're suppressed, whatever. And then when I go, I roll a die. That's how many of my dudes get to go. For Rogue Hammer, it is a little different. You basically get a set number of actions. You get some full actions where a unit can like move and shoot or move and use a psychic power. And you get some partial actions where you can only do one thing. So if I have like a transport, I might just take one of the partial actions for that and move those because I don't want to shoot with that unit anyway. But the unit that they disembark out might take a full action from the ones I have available. Because I want those to both move and shoot. But if I'm disembarking them somewhere where they can't see for shit anyway, I might not need a full action for them because that's just going to be wasted. Or if I have a heavy weapons unit sitting back, they're not really moving a lot, so I might only take partial actions with them. But the idea is that you can only take a certain number of actions each turn, unless your army is really small, because then you can cover everybody. So if you have like a big army, you kind of have to like pick who is doing stuff at the time, and you'll have troops kind of naturally hang back in reserve because you can't activate everything each turn. So it creates this sort of interesting effect. It also has, it offsets a little bit. If you are playing a game where one side has way more units than the other, it kind of offsets a little bit because the outnumbered side, if you have like 8 units, you can activate 6 of them. I have 15 units, but I'm still activating 6. I kind of have to like attack in waves, or I can bring up dudes. And whereas you will be activating most of your guys each time, so that's like an interesting effect. There's a little bit of response if you're within a certain range, like close range, you shoot back when you're shot at, and troops can fight back in close combats. So you're not completely sitting on your ass, but it kind of gets you through the turns a little faster. So that's kind of the last of the three like key things. Like Squad Hammer is a very simple engine. Rogue Hammer I kind of jazzed up a little bit with more detail, but that's kind of like the most of it. You know, limited activations, unit-based shooting, and hit.
That's a really good way to show the elite armies, being the smaller units, of course.
Yeah.
Because they're always efficient with their turns compared to a giant force, which can only react so much.
Yeah, or if you like to do scenarios where, like, one side is fighting, like, a huge enemy army, then it makes it a little more exciting because you can kind of, like, oh, okay, like, fight off the first wave, but they still have dudes coming, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it works pretty well that way.
Nice. And then the last question is, based on the provided PDF... Oh, no, that's me. that's the question I asked for AI. Okay.
I mean, I can try to answer for the robot, like, what I think the question would be.
Ivan, can you just send me the questions I should ask you?
Why are you so great? Well, that's an interesting story. It began when I was little.
And now I'm big and better.
Yeah, a lot bigger, as it turned out.
So the next section then will be design and world building.
Hey.
So the question is, Rogue Hammer includes a wide variety of army lists, from that classic grim dark factions like the Imperial Legion and Space Orcs to expanded universe lists inspired by history and other sci-fi media. What was your process for creating these armies? And that is quite a process, right?
Yeah, actually, so I think I've mentioned before that I used to hate doing army lists, but I kind of came around to it. However, it was a big process. So the Grimdark army lists are basically real Warhammer. And what I tried to do was go through every single thing, White Dwarf magazine, book, everything published for Rogue Trader and second edition 40K, and anything that even remotely looked like an army list went in the book. Not all of them are done yet. So you have all the basic ones. They're all, of course, renamed because we're not, you know, trying to rip anything off. So nothing is like, there's no like copywritten terms in there. So, you know, some of them like Gene Steelers became assimilator cults and stuff like that. Squats became space dwarfs. Like, but there's also some that were very minor. Like, I think the Citadel Journal magazine had like a space pirate list. So that went in. Yeah. There was like a rogue trader list. So that went in. I also added a couple. There's a hired guns list for some of the weird little alien units. And I added a rebel and dissident list, which I always thought should be there for like general rebels. I also took the chance while doing that of adding a little bit of characters to them. So the idea is each of the army lists has every single unit that I could find. So like the Imperial Legion list, which is the Space Marine list, or Imperial Guard list, has every single squad and tank that I could find for Rogue Trader or Second Edition, except for a few where they were merged together. Like there were some units that were so close that I merged them. And there's also a couple of cases where a unit was actually split up to become like two different units. But the idea is that everything that you could have back then is reflected somewhere somehow, with very few exceptions. I think there's one or two things that I ended up binning. And then there's a couple of tweaks. Like, I always thought it was cool that, like, originally gene stealers were not part of the Tyranids. So that's how it works here. They're their own thing. And there's a few like that. The expanded lists are basically things that I just thought would be cool to add. Most of those are not completed yet, but they will be. But they will include stuff like being able to use, like, World War II British or World War I minis. There'll be options to use, like, Star Wars stuff and a bunch of other things. One of the stupid lists that I want to do is that you can take BattleTech figures and use them to fight, like, your Warhammer army.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like bionic, like battle suits or something. So some of them will just be like stupid fun. But the idea is that if you want to play like real Warhams, you can use the Grimdark list and you'll be fine. If you want to play with everything, then you can use the expanded list and then you can do like crazy stuff. So you can have the Imperial Rebels from not Star Wars, you know, joining forces with some space elves and stuff. And part of it is just, like, allow people to, like, play games that, you know, like, if I don't have a Warhammer army, but I do have a, like, bolt-action British army, why can't we play a game? Like, you know, the British can fight the Space Orcs, that's fine.
Oh, yeah.
As a note on the historical list, because a couple of people had asked about that, they're not really intended to be like hardcore like World War II or World War I lists. They are like World War I models or World War II models in Roguehammer. So like if a trench warfare army had to like fight 40k armies, like what would that look like kind of thing?
Okay.
So the idea is you use the real models, but they're not necessarily like, it might be that if you had those armies fight each other, it would actually play out like a World War I game. But that's not really the intent, necessarily. They're just like, it's just goofiness.
Yeah, and of course, somehow, it's amazing that World War I, Lou's guns can penetrate the Star Knight's armor.
Yeah. I'm also putting a list in for Napoleon Knights, so hold that thought. Because it turns out musketry can bring down like Space Marine Terminators.
Yeah, it's probably magic powder.
Yeah, it could be.
Mind
lightning, lightning powder and adamantium bullets.
So, yeah.
But yeah, it's just all like goofiness. Like some of the Warhammer style demons will be supplemented with like demons from Doom, the computer game.
Fun.
Yeah. So, you know, like it's one of those things, like you can add a little like character to it. So it is Roguehammer. It's not, you know, Grimdark something something.
Yeah. Now, to circle back to the things you binned in the Grimdark, where would be the best place for someone to curse your name and hold a grudge for you for all time?
So I will say, if you find something that is actually missing, I will give you a thumbs up because that means you're a super nerd, because that would have been something that was like deep, deep within like the realm of Chaos book or something. Like we're talking deep dive, so we could almost make it like a game show thing. You can find like... there was weird, obscure stuff in there that I pulled out and put in.
Nice.
Like if somebody has the White Dwarf article with the original, like, Mentor Legion Space Marines, they're in the game. So, yeah, we're going deep. But there are a couple of little things. And I may also absolutely have, like, missed one. Like, I think Noise Marines are actually still not on the list. I'll have to check that.
So, actually, this kind of relates to the next question, so I'll just ask you now.
Yeah.
Many of the army lists are marked as incomplete.
Yes.
Can you give us a sneak peek into what's coming next for the game? Are there any specific factions or units you're particularly excited about?
Hey, so when I write the list, I'm trying to like be into each list in turn. Like when I play 40K, I mostly played Imperial Guard, except for a brief stint of Space Wolves. So, but I try to like be excited about like portraying the army in some way. Because when you do an army, like, you have to create the units. They also have to have, like, one or two special rules. They have to have a couple of upgrades, a couple of psionic powers. So it's, like, how do you reflect the character of the army with, like, very few pieces? Because you can't make, like, it's the wrong game to have, like, 200, like, pieces of war gear or whatever. It has to be a little more concise than that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can only pick, like, five, like, unit upgrades for orcs, what five things do you want to give them, kind of thing.
Okay.
As far, so the whole list, we could just do like a rundown here. So if you're listening at home, you can, and if you're not listening at home, I guess you'd be in the car.
Yeah. Yeah. Driving on the subway.
Yeah. Walking. Driving on the subway.
Yeah. Driving on the subway.
You're the driver. Total list of armies are as okay. We'll do this. I will say the names of the armies and you tell me what they are from 40K.
Okay.
And then, okay. So first we have the Imperial Legion.
That's the Imperial Guard.
Yes. We have the Star Knights.
Okay. The Space Marines. Yeah.
We have Imperial Personalities. That's just kind of a catch-all.
Okay. We have Imperial Agents. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We have Free Traders.
The Rogue Traders. Yeah. Yeah.
Got yep. Rebels and Dissidents.
That's the not existing ones.
Yeah. That's like a new one. Although it fits.
You can be like Necromunda, I guess, right?
Yeah.
With, it's like Hive Scum and stuff.
Yeah. It's like crime gangs and mutants and cultists, kind of like a mush. So a bunch of different armies can use those as allies. I just thought it should exist.
Yeah.
We got space orcs with a C.
Yes.
That's how you can tell the difference. we got space elves.
With a Z.
we have the crawler horde.
Crawler horde. Nice. Crawlers. Who crawls? Tyranid. Is it the Tyranid? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. We have the killbots.
Okay. Yeah. Like the KS androids, as they were known back then.
We have hired guns, which is an added list. We have space dwarves. We have the war jesters.
Oh, yes, yes. The Harlequins.
Yep. Assimilator cults.
That's the... Oh, yeah, the gene stealers, yeah.
Uh-huh. Then we have hell servants.
Oh, that must be the fine fellows of chaos.
Yep. The witch slayers.
Which could be witch hunters, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like witch hunters. This is a battle. We have the coalition.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's the Tau. Yeah.
Yes. We have elf raiders.
Yeah, the Dark Eldar. Nice.
Yep. And they also like end up absorbing like because they used to be like pirate squads and stuff that don't exist anymore. So they kind of became like a mix of those.
Oh, from the Eldar?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Corsairs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They kind of like...
They still kind of exist in the fluff, but not really.
Yeah, they just haven't been like a thing. So I thought, okay, why don't we just merge those two? And then we have Orc Renegades.
Ooh, Orc Renegades.
Yeah, so they're basically... It's a bunch of stuff from the original like Orc books of like weird Orc units. So it's like all the Orcs that are like too crazy to hang out with the regular Orcs. Then we have Hell Renegades.
The Bad Knights. Of chaos,
they are like the scum, and like this is where you find like trolls and mutants, and degenerate humans and stuff.
Okay,
it's kind of like a realm of chaos thing. It's like it's a little bit of like what was like the Lost and the Damned list when they had those.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Machine cultists.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't remember their names. Astromeal. No.
Yeah. Mechanicus.
Yeah, that's it.
We got space pirates. Which is Space Pirates. That's a Citadel Journal list. Elf Exiles, which is the original like Eldar Exodites. They have these, they never made models for them, but they were basically like outcast Eldar that like live on primitive worlds and ride dinosaurs.
Oh, okay. That's fun.
So I was like, how could you not have like Eldar who ride dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then there are, or will be, Hell Demons, which I just mentioned. That's going to be the Chaos Demons plus also like the demons from Doom, just because it was being weird. And that's the extent of the Grimdark list. Then for the expanded list, we have the Verdanites, which is the World War One army list.
Okay, yeah.
So if you want to bring your Mark IV tank and some World War One infantry, that's your thing. The Royal Commonwealth of Planets, which is the British army in World War Two.
Okay.
I might do like space commies as well. We'll see. For Star Wars, there will be the Galactic Alliance and the Galactic Dominion.
What's the difference?
Not Star Wars. The Alliance is the Rebels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And then
so the Dominion would be the rightful rulers. Yeah.
Yes. But they couldn't be the Empire because there's a lot of Empire already.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had to be something else. Then definitely not Doctor Who. There will be the Time Guard, and which is will be like Time Lords and different unit and... And then the Time War Conspiracy, which would be like a certain screeching, exterminating robot thing and their minions. And then Mech Clans, which would be the dumb idea for being able to use Battletech figures. And then Napoleonites. And the last one probably will be the Spice Collectors, which will be based on Dune. specifically okay, old computer games. So that's kind of the extent of the madness.
The how far away from second edition was Gorka Morka?
That was at the tail end of second.
Okay, because I think he could really sneak in the GRC.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, once you kind of have, like, the framework and it's sort of established that it's a bit goofy, there's, like, a lot of things you can suddenly, like, kind of pull in, depending. Yeah. You just have to have, like, enough units to make, like, an army list out of it.
So it's always my mark of excellence is if you can include a good goblin list, then
get
the stamp of approval.
Some goblins in there, but a straight-up, like, goblin rebel list would be pretty fun to do, actually.
Yeah, you can't have orcs in a goblin list. It's disgusting.
Yeah. The little dudes is getting like stomped on, but a lot of these army lists are still unfinished, obviously, because there's just a lot of it, so they're kind of included so you can get an idea of like what will happen. Then a couple of lists will get finished each month.
I mean, that's a massive amount of forces, so
it is a massive amount. I think I counted something like 450 individual unit profiles by now, so it is absolutely the mostest.
That's why it's taken up most of your life.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right, so the last question for the design and world building will be the designer's notes section at the end of the rulebook is a staple for the Nordic Weasel Games living rulebooks.
Yes.
Was there any particular version that has an interesting story or design challenge associated with it for Rogue Hammer?
Not specifically. The idea of the army list has changed a little bit over the because I had to kind of like figure out how to do them. And there was a lot of things that ended up changing. Like the original psychic powers changed to be more easy to use and easier to make like specific powers for each army and stuff like that. So it's been more of an organic thing where like as the core rules have like gotten hammered out in response to like what people came up with and what people told me, then like the more they like fell into place, then the army list kind of like fall after that.
Okay.
So yeah, it's more of like a fluid, organic process. Then it's not real, like sharply delineated into like specific editions or versions.
Okay, perfect. So the third section will be community and future.
Hey.
The rule book mentions that continued development of the game depends on your support through your Patreon. How does player feedback directly influence the updates and new content for Rogue Hammer?
Yeah, well, it does in two ways. First of all, if people complain about something, I might listen. Now, I think by now the rules are mostly like nailed down. But like, for example, one guy went through and he found like, I forget what it was now. It was like something with close combat that was like spread all over the rules. So he created like a little box that had all the information in. I put that in. And then a couple other people were like really excited because that was like a big help to them. So sometimes it's stuff like that. Like if there's a rule that is like unclear to you or you just think of a better way, it could be presented. Like stuff like that can always make it in. An awful lot of like points values have been adjusted up or down like a tiny bit, just based on people noticing like, oh, these two units are pretty similar, but this one is like a little better. So like it should be a point more or less. One of the things I really want to do the more people play games is to be able to take, because a lot of the points values, like you can't write 450 unit profiles and have them all like match up. It's just not going to happen. So one of the hopes is that as people play more and more games, you know, they can email me and like, hey, we played and like this tank is like a little too good and that squad is a little too bad and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go in and make like a little tweak. You know, if it's a little too good, maybe the points cost just need to go up by like 2 points. So maybe it needs like one less point to hit or something, you know. Like, it can be a small change to just bring it closer to where it, like, ought to be. So that's, like, the big thing. Like, if you run into a stumbling block with the rules, or if you, just from playing the game and seeing, like, what is really good and what is not so good, and then let me know. Everything is considered, nothing is wrong.
And if someone really wants a faction that you're not into for Rogue Hammer, they should join your Patreon and ask every single month as their subscription renews. And eventually they'll hit that magic point where all of a sudden the army appears, right?
Yeah. You get an extra. I take it more seriously the more you pledge for on Patreon. joking aside, like, yeah, Patreon is obviously like the big, like stuff like this and the amount of work that goes into it. Like, it's a lot more work than just the number of copies that the game sells. So if you can support on Patreon, that definitely helps things like this happen. And that's kind of like the original reason for the Patreon. It was never like supposed to just be like five Parsec scenarios or something like that. Although I enjoyed doing those and it's good that those are there. But it was also always supposed to be like being able to like continue developing games and spend time on them, add new units and new armies and stuff like that. So it's kind of the perfect case for it. So yeah, get over there, open your wallet. You can even like sign up for a whole year, in which case you get something. It's like 10% off or something.
Yeah, you get that's a pretty good chunk change.
Yeah, get a little bit off, and that way you don't have to. A lot of people get like, at least sometimes I hear from people, they don't necessarily mind like paying for something like a Patreon, but they don't like having something because you come out every month, because then like if your card is like really close to its balance because you use like at cards you don't use that often or something. So yeah, you can pay one shot, you get a little bit cheaper, and then you don't like have to worry about it until next time, you know. So yeah, that's kind of how it works. But it's also a way of just like having like, I think this matters to a certain kind of player, of having a game that's like responsive to you, you know, like you can actually influence like the development of the game. You can get a real answer from like the person who's working on it and stuff like that. It's not just like corporate slop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's indie slop.
Indie slop. The best of slops.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so our next question is, you encourage players to use miniatures they already own, emphasizing that the game is flexible to a wide range of figures. What is the importance of this miniatures agnostic approach to you as a game designer?
Yeah, well, so I'm going to answer that in relation to Roguehammer, because it's a little different when you write something like 5 Parsecs where there literally aren't miniatures, but in this case there is, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can go buy a Warhammer army. Like, you could buy, if you buy, like, a squad of 10 Space Marines, like, in a box, you basically have, like, one character and three full squads for Roguehammer. So, it's very efficient. But I think I wanted, because the idea is, like, if you have, like, the Space Elves in Roguehammer, they're not Eldar, they're Space Elves, right? Now, it might be that it just so happens that your Space Elves are looking an awful lot like real Eldar miniatures. But it might also be that you saw some definitely not Eldar minis like that somebody made, and you really want to use those. So those are just as official Space Elf squads as anything that that other company makes. Or, you know, like there's a lot of like definitely not Space Marine models out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason that your army can't be those, and like that's real and official, because that's, you know, how the thing works.
Yeah. There's a lot of spicy Eldar models out there too from other companies. There's,
yeah, there's a lot. There's definitely there's some that are a little easier to find stuff for. But I just wanted to be, you know, like maybe you're building like your assimilator cult, but instead of using gene stealers, you want to use like the what's the company that does the aliens board game?
Oh, that is a Battlefront. Did it? But Gale Force 9.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you want to use the Gale Force 9 Xenomorphs instead of Gene Sealers. Like, okay, those are official. Like, you can do that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's, like, the big thing of, like, because it's just a way of letting you inject, like, a little more, like, your dudes. And especially with all the stuff, like, there's a lot of, because you always see this thing of people who buy, like, you know, some unofficial, like, models they use as Imperial Guard or Space Marines or something, but you can't bring them to like the store or something if your store is like real tight, because mm-hmm. they're not real or whatever. So, Roguehammer, it's yours. You can they can be real if you want them to.
Bring them to the Roguehammer store.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very small store. It's just like next to the bin out back.
Yeah, that's right. The next question is: the game includes rules for solo gaming. How do you approach designing for a single player, and what do you see as the benefits of playing the game solo?
Well, the benefit is, I guess, just you don't have to have somebody else. we've sort of talked about that in an old episode, but like sometimes you want to just play on your own, like because you know your friend is busy or you live someplace, you can't. There isn't a group to play with, right? But I think sometimes also like, it's just a different experience. You can sit and kind of tinker with it. And like, you know, you play a couple of turns, you go do something else. You come back and play another turn. Same for some people. It's like a different experience. Or maybe like the group you play with is really into something different. Like you're playing War Machine right now or something. Everyone dug out all their old mechs and dudes. But you still want to get in some like sci-fi. So you just play a solo game on your own. And then on club night, you go play War Machine.
You once ruled the realms with dice and a sword, painted goblins till tea, then your minis were stored. You grew up, got a job, bought a flat, wore a tie, swapped dragons for deadlines, your brushes went dry. Now the dishes are done and the kids are in bed. You climb to the attic to raise the undead. Crack open the paints that you swore you'd outgrown. The smell of acrylic, it feels like your home. There's grey in your beard, even more on your head, but you're splashing some colour on plastic and lead. So welcome back, General. What took you so long? Your hobby's still here. It's the place you belong. The Bedroom Battlefields Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Find it at bedroombattlefields.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like, it could be a bunch of different. To me, it's really more about, like, allowing people to game in situations where they might not normally. As far as the solo mechanics, they're fairly straightforward. It's actually the exact same ones that are in Squad Hammer. So the AI has an edge on you because it always activates all of its troops. But because it's essentially programmed, it's not rolling dice for what it does. So you can kind of predict what it, like, each unit type will act in a very specific way. So the idea is that the AI can, like, overwhelm you, but they can also, like, you can kind of outwit them if you know that they're going to fight in a certain way. Like, any units that are classified as shooters will always target the closest enemy they can see. So you can, like, pull them off or something, you know.
Okay.
It may still need, like, a little tweaking, because there are some cases where it can get weird. Like, the AI has way more units than you. You'll probably just get trounced, but
yeah,
it's a work in progress. But it's really there to, like, let you play the game. I think a lot of people also just, like, play two-handed or two-fisted.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can just do that.
And, of course, they say the problem with indie wargaming is often finding players. So if you don't have to find the player, then you don't have to worry.
Yeah, yeah. You can play indie. Again, like, if you're in a position where, like, you can't get a game together for literally any reason, then that's an option for you. And that it just, yeah, it, I used to not think about it that much, but, like, over the years I've gotten, like, a lot of emails from people who are, like, really thankful that, like, there was a game they could play when they're in a situation where they can't, like, they're traveling for, you know, out of the country for a month, they brought some minis with them, but, you know, they're just in a hotel room somewhere, or, like, they were during a lockdown, or, you know, whatever. Like, there could be a million reasons you can't go somewhere and play. So
yeah, or you live in this small town that's far away from everything, and everyone that hates wargaming. So
devil's magic. So whatever the situation is, you know, you have a way of doing some gaming. I think that's really important.
Yeah. And our final question for Roguehammer will be: what's your ultimate vision for Roguehammer? Where do you hope to see the game in 5 years, both in terms of content and community?
Yeah,
that's a very AI question.
Yeah, that's very, I could tell, like, the ellipses afterwards. In terms of content, I would say by then, like, all the army lists are done. There's probably a couple more, like, fun lists that have been added. Probably by then, at least one, like, fan-made list has been contributed and has made it into the game for real. More scenarios. The book is, like, a trillion pages by then, because it's already so big. In terms of community, I would say if it is mentioned as being the second best option or alternative for Warhams players, I think that would be pretty good. Because I don't think, because it's not like a very glossy book and it's not accompanied by its own miniatures and stuff, I don't think it's really in the same category as OPR, and I don't think the goals are the same necessarily. But I think if it can get to a point where people will bring it up as the other option for people, I think that would be, you know, like, hey, you might want to check out Grimdark Firefight or Roguehammer.
So absolutely.
I think that would be, and that depends as much on, like, community as anything else. I think it's starting to pick up steam. Of course, in 5 years, it could also be everyone moved on.
So. I'd say. In 5 years. So if you are interested in picking up Roguehammer, we, of course, have a link below to the Wargame Vault page.
Yep.
Not DriveThruRPG. I don't even know if it's on there, but we don't endorse
it that site. Not because I try to. It's technically the same site on the back.
Yeah.
But I try to be really good about only putting stuff where it's supposed to go, because I know the guy who is, like, my contact at Wargame Vault, he takes that, like, pretty seriously. He gets really frustrated when the RPG dudes, like, dump their shit all over Wargame Vault. So I try to like be good about that. But yeah, you can go grab it, and all updates are like totally free. Like,
because it's a living rule book, so it's always going to be evolving for the times.
Yep, and that's the thing. Like, because it's like taking advantage of the fact that it's PDF, right? Like, you can, if we're not doing a print book at the moment because it's changing so frequently, then might as well take advantage of the fact that you can always have like the most updated book.
Perfect. Okay, so that will wrap up the Rogue Hammer portion of the show. I'm just going to touch base. Don Juan Don is here. He's got the golden voice. I want to get him on the podcast someday.
Oh.
Yeah, he's very suave.
Okay, well, we need that because we're kind of crude.
Yeah, exactly. Solo wargaming is a great way to know I can actually get painted models on the table.
Yes.
They also lend themselves well to playing co-op with other people, of course, which AI never brought up, but as we all
know. Yeah, that is very true. Like, there's nothing, any game that is solo, you can play with a friend. Like, you're just on the same side. And yeah, it is great. Like, some people are really put off by the idea of like a very competitive game, or even just a competitive game they don't know real well. So it's a way of like dipping your toes in. And maybe after you play together a couple of times, maybe they want to try like fighting each other now that they kind of know how the game works. So yeah, that's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now we're going to move on to the brand new Nordic Weasel Games title.
Yeah, the historical stuff.
Which I keep trying to pluralize one or the other, or both sometimes. Yes. But it is Musket 2 Rifle.
Yes. And actually, there was an old game that was called something like From Muskets to Rifles. So it being singular is actually important.
Okay, perfect. So an elevator pitch for this one.
Yes, it is large-ish skirmish in the 19th century. And by large-ish, I mean like 30, 40 guys. Basically, buy a box of 172 scale like plastics or a box of Perry Napoleonics or something and have a skirmish action. You know, patrols, foragers, stuff like that, due to brightly colored uniforms, shooting at each other.
Nice. So we'll go into the first round of questions, which is game design and philosophy.
Hey.
The rulebook for Musket to Rifle is a workhorse system designed to be easy to understand and familiar to players. What were the most challenging aspects of designing a system that balances historical fidelity with intuitive gameplay?
That is super AI.
Super AI.
But it is a good question because there are some things, whenever you do historical stuff, you kind of have to like pick and choose a little bit. You can pick your things that you want to emphasize, but there's also the things you're going to have to like let go. So like the obvious one is that if when you read an account of like two, like a company of troops skirmishing and trading shots with some enemies, they would be there for like 3 hours trading shots with each other. Because skirmishing, it turns out that with a black powder rifle or black powder musket, shooting at some dudes like way over there behind some bushes is not real accurate. So, and obviously you can't really like have a game play out that way. You have to be a little more decisive. You have to kind of tune it up a bit. So we're kind of like, we're skipping that part and going to the part where like they're getting a little too close and it's getting a little too hot. What you can do, on the other hand, so this is where you pull out something to emphasize. What was really important was that it was a true skirmish, that the game, the units and the game would play out like they were men who had been sent out to skirmish, which for the non-historical nerds means sending troops out, you know, kind of typically you're going like in pairs or you're like out in a chain with like a couple of paces between each man. And they're kind of like loading and firing individually at individual targets. You're not shooting in ranks or anything like that. Skirmishers might be sent out to screen the main army to contest some objective, to snipe at the enemy. And of course, if you send out your skirmishers, the other guys are going to send out theirs. And then, you know, they spend some time shooting at each other before the battle gets on. So it was important that it felt like a, like that's actually what is happening. Because I played a lot of so-called skirmish games where you're like 12 dudes are still trying to like line up in ranks or form squares, which is bananas. That's not a thing. That doesn't happen. So here there's none of that. Like everything is legitimately, if you see 12 guys on the table in like a unit, that's 12 guys with muskets. They're not standing in for a company of guys. They're not standing in for anything. It's 12 guys. If they are strung out along a hedgerow, then that means your dudes are strung out along that hedgerow. So it's meant to be very sort of specific in that sense. That also meant that some things, like there's no rules for artillery because you don't really shoot artillery at like a skirmish line. Like a cannonball is just going to fly past them. So again, it's meant to be like a real skirmish game.
The most legit of skirmish games.
The most skirmishest.
So the next question will be, you describe the game as big skirmish, typically involving 4 to 5 units of 10 figures each. Can you explain why you chose this scale over larger engagements or smaller skirmishes? How does this size impact the game's tactical feel?
Well, the reason for that is very simple. If you buy a box of like hat miniatures, like 172 scale figures, you probably get like 45 or 50 guys. So when we tested the very original version of it, we had bought 2 boxes of Napoleonic dudes. Mm-hmm. And we picked out a couple of guys who were officers and the rest of them were divided up into 4 squads each. And then we shot at each other. That's how the game started, and that's why that's the intended size. And from there, a lot of things then happen. Like, if you have that many dudes, you don't necessarily want, like, each guy individually to do too much. You don't want to have, so, like, some dudes are moving and some are standing and shooting. You want to have, like, unit orders. You know, you don't want to track, like, which guys have to reload and stuff. You just want to have that, like, abstracted into combat. So instead of, like, tracking reloading, you just have a penalty for moving and firing that depends on the weapon. So troops with, like, breech-loading rifles can move and fire better than troops with muzzleloaders because they take longer to reload. So once you know, like, how many guys you're going to have, that, like, answers a lot of questions for you about what the game is, the mechanics of the game going to look like. So
okay. Then we'll move on to the next question. The game covers a wide historical period from the Wars of the Spanish Succession to the late 1800s. How did you ensure that the core rules remain consistent while accurately representing the significant changes in weaponry, tactics, and technology over more than a century of warfare?
Yeah, that's one of those questions like super nerds will ask.
Yeah, yeah.
and to an extent, you kind of just have to like say that it does. But the basic idea of infantry skirmishing and hasn't really changed very much throughout the period. As you get to the end of the period, you start getting like rifles showing up, like more and more combat is skirmishing because you're just going to get shot to pieces. But the basic idea of sending out like a scattered detachment of men who are going to go out and like pick shots and snipe at enemy sentries and stuff, that really doesn't read very different if you read them like somebody's diary from the Napoleonic Wars versus a diary from like the Franco-Prussian War. Like the basic ideas of that are the same. So a lot of it can be handled in things like the weapons as you progress through. And you can almost do this thing where you like pick a war at the beginning of the period and then you like move up. So like when you get like percussion caps instead of matchlocks or flintlocks, then like some of the random events that cause like bad weather will not affect you as much. So you have like a little edge. When rifles start showing up, you get more range. When breech loaders show up, you get more like more shots and less penalties for moving and stuff. So some of it can be a little gear specific because changes in weapons are such a huge deal in this period. Skis has a little question if you want to throw that one in.
Yeah. So I'll read it out loud. Does the game support all cavalry engagement? Engagements. From my very limited 19th century warfare knowledge, a lot of skirmish engagements happened between opposing light cavalry detachments.
Yes. So there are, I think, 4 cavalry types in there. And yes, we didn't. Originally, there were going to be like army building rules, but somebody pointed out, like, why don't you just let people figure that out themselves? So you can, like, as far as like building an army out of points, you just pick whatever you want. If you technically want an army made entirely of like sergeants, you can probably just do that, but it would be stupid. But yes, you can build an all cavalry army, and you can have cavalry dismount to then fight on foot, like dragoon style. And there are options for taking heavy cavalry. They tend to kind of get shot to bits if they're just on their lonesome, but that's fine. But yeah, light cavalry, like American Civil War style, like skirmishing each other, you can totally do that. You can have dragoons that are like dismounting to fight with carbines and stuff. So yeah, cavalry is definitely covered.
Sweet. Then final question in the game design and philosophy section is, the rule book mentions 2 approaches to historical wargaming. realistic and dramatic. Can you elaborate on how a player might use the provided rules to lean into one style versus the other, perhaps with an example from a specific conflict, like the American Civil War or the Napoleonic Wars?
Hey, see, it's so educational. Mm-hmm. So accurate is that you are trying to be some degree of simulation. So the example I give in the book is like, if you have a book about like heroic actions in the Napoleonic Wars. So you might pick out one of those and say, okay, I know the exact regiment that was fighting here and I know where they fought. I can look up like what that looks like. Maybe I even have a map. You try to like build something looking like that. Like you're trying to be like specific to like what actually happened at a certain time, or like very specific to what you know, like your action might be, one that didn't really happen, but that could have happened. You're trying to say, okay, you know, it's the Prussians versus the French, and you want to have a infantry skirmish, like, while they're both, like, contesting a bridge somewhere. And you're setting up, like, a pretty realistic setup, which is probably, like, the same kind of infantry on both sides, right? Like, because mm-hmm. they're from the same unit. The dramatic approach is basically, it can still be realistic, but it tends to be a little more aimed at, like, being colorful. So if I'm building a more dramatic army of like French, Franco-Prussian war soldiers, maybe I want to have a squad of like French Marines just because I painted some and they look different, look cool. Like, would there be one squad of Marines with like a bunch of regular army guys? Like, no, like they would be in their own unit. But in a dramatic game, it's as important to like, you know, it's driven by like your toy soldiers. You painted some mm-hmm. new guys, you want to use those. So it's a little more, sometimes like your army can be like a microcosm of the actual army. So maybe you have like, if you have like two squads or two units of cavalry as like a Russian player, maybe you take like one unit of Cossacks and one unit of like something else. Cause a large army would have both. So your little tabletop army is like shrunk down, you know? So instead of having like three regiments of regular cavalry, three regiments of Cossacks, your little tabletop army just has one squad of each. Boop.
Okay.
So it's like a micro, it's like a bathtub army, right?
Nice. So it's just the My Dude situation for the dramatic effect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like you're just being more, yeah, it's like, it's my shelf, right?
Yeah. This is what I grabbed. This is what I'm playing with.
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay, so the next we'll go into mechanics and gameplay. A notable feature is that a unit doesn't test morale for losing just one figure, as some steady attrition is expected. Yes. This goes against some other war games. Could you elaborate on the historical research or design philosophy that led to this decision?
Yeah, well, so the original idea is actually from KPS, because I just like the effect that you can lose a guy and... Now, in that game, it was because you were supposed to be, like, medieval troops, and they were supposed to be, like, hard men. Like, they probably, like, had three of their kids die of the plague that morning. See, one of their friends, like, get an arrow in the balls, that's not, like, that big a deal.
No. Yeah.
But it also kind of worked. Here's the thing. Probably if a squad of skirmishers had, like, one guy shot, they would be, like, discomfited, like, a bit, because, like, a dude just got shot. Mm-hmm. But when you read, like, accounts of firefights with skirmishers, they're in the line for like a long time, and they'll kind of have like wounded men like drift back to the main unit, or like a guy like helps somebody and then comes back, or you know, one guy gets wounded, like seven of them go to the rear because it's you find a reason, right?
Yeah.
But they would kind of stay in the line for like a long time. Skirmishers would only usually break if like they get hit really hard, or like you get outflanked and shot to bits, or if somebody like makes a point of coming over there with like swords and bayonets, and then suddenly it's business time. So it's a case where like the rules specifically may or may not be realistic, but the vibe that it produces is realistic. It basically means that if you're just taking like one loss, like each time you activate, you're basically like still going to be in line. Like they might be worried for a moment, but they kind of like pull back together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of designing for effect, I think the actual pros call it.
I do like the thought of someone shooting at each other for 3 hours, and then they're like, okay, you know what? We're done with this. Let's just go over there and chop them.
Yeah,
it's chopping time.
Like somebody either gets sent in or like some cavalry shows up to like wreck everyone's shit and you just run away. So, you can find all kinds of like generals, letters, and memoirs being like frustrated because like the skirmishes aren't achieving anything. Actually, a true historical fact, skirmishing was actually something that you would often volunteer for because it was relatively safe and you got to like do your part. So you can stand out there in the bushes and burn off your ammunition, then you can head back to the supply column. As opposed to the guys who has to go in and like get shot at with cannon and stuff.
Ooh, yeah. Work smarter, not harder. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. So the next question will be, the book includes an optional lull in fighting mechanic triggered by a time track. What role does this play in the game? And why did you decide to make it a central rather than optional rule?
So it actually comes from an old game called 1916. It was like a free game. It might still be out there, I'm not sure, but it had this mechanic where like there would be a break in the game, and I always just thought it was really cool. You got to like regroup a little bit, bring a couple of troop stands back. But it was also a thing that seems like it often happens when you read about like firefights and battles. It will just be a period where like things chill out a little bit. Everyone is like, they kind of burn through the ammunition. They need to like, you know, like one guy's out of ammo, so he needs to like get some bullets from another guy. You kind of like get your wounded guys pulled back. You find the dude who's hiding in a ditch and it's actually okay. And you sort of like get everything back. And then like at some point, somebody like blows the whistle and you throw everyone back into it. So I wanted to have that effect. It also makes for a useful like a midpoint. Like you can set up the game. So the standard is that if you're not playing a specific number of turns, the game ends the second time a lull occurs. Now, for the scenarios, it's usually just a set number of turns because with scenarios, you probably want to have it a little more tight. But it does allow you, if you're playing kind of open-ended, then yeah, the first lull is like the halfway point. You've been slugging it out for like an hour. Timing system. It also, I like the idea that you can get a couple of guys back and then, you know, and kind of throw yourself back into it. So maybe now you have enough guys you want to like try to turn their flank or like run up that hill or something.
Okay, yeah, it's chopping time now. Mm-hmm. Better break, time to chop.
Yeah, now it's going to get even.
All right, so the last question for the mechanics and gameplay section will be, the standard deployment section provides a detailed process for setting up a battle, including rolling a D10 to modify a force's strategic rating. What does this add to the game compared to a simpler method, like players taking turns placing units?
Yeah, that bit is a remnant from the fact that the game originally started out as a hack of a Warhammer 40K Second Edition. It doesn't resemble it that much anymore, although now that I say it, people will be able to tell. If you kind of squint a little bit, but that game had strategy ratings that determined like who set up in what order. So I just kind of like that idea. I like the idea. Now you do kind of have to set the strategy ratings yourself. Probably in the future there will be some suggested ratings for armies, but you might say like if one side is like the French under Napoleon, they have a higher strategy rating than their opponents. So typically their opponents would have to set up first. But there is a die roll, so it can be modified a little bit. So sometimes, you know, the Russians will like pull a trigger on them and they won't have to set up first. So it's kind of just because it was there when we first started testing it. But I also just like the effect of it. But if you don't like it, you could just treat the armies as the same and then roll the dice.
Okay. So we'll move on to the third section of the questions, which is player experience and community. Mm-hmm. Campaign rules include a personal game element, allowing a player to follow a single character through battles. This is a unique feature for a historical war game. What inspired you to include this, and how does it enhance the overall experience?
I don't actually know what the inspiration was. I just thought it's something that was cool. It may be subconsciously from the original Squad Leader or something like that, because that had a thing like that. But I've thought for a while that it's cool. It's actually something we used to do way back in the day. We would play like Warhammer Fantasy and you would pick out one guy in like a regiment or something that was your dude. And then at the end of the game, we would see like what happened with your dude. Like, you know, is he still alive? Did he see some crazy shit? Like, did that dude have to fight a dragon or something? It was just a way of like sort of getting like an, you know, sometimes you get down and you see the battle from your dude and you realize that man, he doesn't even know there's like a unit of Chaos Knights on the battlefield because he can't see them for shit.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of that. I just thought it was this cool idea that you're playing like this army game, which can sometimes be a little impersonal. So it just puts you in that like, oh, you know, like maybe you start thinking about what would like what would his diary look like, you know, like he was in a firefight, but his experience might have been completely different from that of the army. You know, if he was out on a hill on the side and sniping at, you know, the Germans over there, it may not have been that intense of a battle, even though on the other side, like, you know, a bunch of dudes were like slaughtering each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of just getting a different perspective and getting a little bit of a dual perspective. Plus, if you have a guy you're like responsible for, it'll affect like the way the decisions you make, because suddenly you may be a little more dubious about sending that unit to like sacrifice itself, because that's your dude.
Yeah Can't kill off my dude.
Yeah.
Okay, the next question is, you encourage players to get in touch with errors, suggestions, and feedback. What are some of the most memorable pieces of feedback you've received, and how have they influenced a game's development?
So obviously there's none for this game yet, other than like people help test it. In terms of good advice, a lot of times it's just like people always apologize for this because they'll come up with some like really specific subcase. If this unit is doing this thing while opposed by this in this terrain, and they'll find some like loophole or a thing that doesn't work or something like that. And I know a lot of people don't think that matters, but it does matter to me. Like, the rules should account for something like that. Maybe there's an elegant way. Sometimes it's so obscure, you just have to let it go. Mm-hmm. But I think, just coming up with those weird cases that, you know, because you have a game is like 10,000 different pieces that all like connect and churn around each other. So being able to like pick out like just some interaction that there was no way to prevent, or it never came up in testing because it just, you know, there's only so many things. If you have like a couple of random event tables, this specific combination of events has a 1 in 1,000 chance rate.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like the weirdest, I think I've told this story before, but somebody a long time ago didn't want me to use the word dash for running troops, which I've always done.
Oh, yeah.
because it sounded like Daesh, which is like the Islamic like jihadist terrorist group.
Oh, okay.
And like, yeah, like, thank you for your feedback, sir. You know, like, you can't, sometimes you have to, or sometimes you'll get people who like kind of read the game but they want it to be something else, like that is completely inappropriate for what you were doing, and you just so let it go. Like, okay. In the end, like, it doesn't hurt you to like read the feedback and think about it, but you have to sort of sort through it.
What percentage of responses to players' feedback do you think you have simply said, you handle blank the usual way?
So I try to specifically never do that. a lot of times, if it's an error, then I just say, okay, we'll fix that like as soon as we can. If it is a suggestion for handling something a different way, the answer will usually be either yes, and I'll implement that, I'll think about that, or I will say, yeah, that's a fine, like, alternate way, but, you know, the rule will probably stay the way it is. And that's usually, like, most people who are suggesting, like, alternate ways or optional rules will kind of, that's kind of what they expect.
Yeah.
If somebody is, like, they're unhappy with the rule, or they're asking, like, how something works because they don't think it should work like that, this is maybe more for the historical game. A lot of times what I try to do is like tell them, here's the reason the rule works this way, but you could change it to this, and then, you know, that would work differently. And that's 99% of the time, people are totally fine with that.
Okay.
So, and, but yeah, I try players, to give like specific answers.
Okay. And players' words have a little more weight when they've joined your Patreon, correct? The Nordic Wizard Games Patreon?
Mm-hmm. Yes, each dollar you commit on Patreon is a 1% increase that I take your queries seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts at 1%, so you might want to juice your odds.
Yeah,
it does accumulate, but only for 3 months. Then it starts dropping off. So you gotta keep throwing money on the kitty.
Yeah, you should see your ledgers of tracking.
Yeah, it's quite complicated, actually.
All right, so the next question will be, The rulebook contains a comprehensive list of rifles by nationality and year, which you mentioned is a work in progress. What kind of information are you hoping the community can provide to help expand this appendix?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There was actually a fan that contributed that, and he went through like this massive work of digging through books and Wikipedia articles and stuff, of finding like all kinds of rifles throughout the 19th century, some of which you could find names for, but it's unclear when an army like adopted them. Some of them you can not necessarily even find out how many the army bought, just that they had some at some point. A lot of stuff like that. Some weapons, it's even a little unclear what they necessarily were, especially when it's not. If it's, the more you get into like the fringes of stuff, the more difficult it can be, especially in English. It helps if you read like French or German. Nerds being nerds, this is the sort of thing that...
Sorry?
I was jamming a little bit there. You know, there's going to be some dude out there who's like an expert in Italian like muzzle loaders in the 1800s, and they will know that A, that gun was definitely not used then, and B, we're obviously idiots because we left out this specific weapon used by like naval detachments in Sicily or whatever.
Yeah.
So honestly, it's the kind of thing that people can just, the list is there for Santa to ask, like, this is what we got, and that's as accurate as we could get it. And then when people who really care about that sort of thing provide better information, it can be narrowed down and like chiseled away to be more accurate.
Okay. Yeah. And of course, the aforementioned Patreon will add much weight to such lists. If you want your naval forces to have the right rifles, guys.
Yeah, you might want to I'm going to open your wallet a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the final question for this section and the wrap up for musket to rifle in general will be, for someone new to historical miniatures gaming, what's one piece of advice you'd give them for getting started with musket to rifle?
The one piece of advice would be pick a period that you are at least curious about and ideally like passionate about. If you don't try to pick something that you think will be easier, like if you really want to play like American Civil War, then get miniatures and start with that. Don't think that you have to start with Napoleonics because that's the core of most Black Powder games or something. Or don't think that if you really want to play, you know, like the Boer War, then do that. Don't worry about the fact whether like starting the game with magazine rifles will like unbalancing or something. Just go with the period you're passionate about. That'll carry you the rest of the way.
Okay. So,
and then you might find that, oh, okay, now that we're into the rules, maybe I do want to do some Napoleonics or something. Then you can just get some more dudes and learn how the game changes between like different. But yeah, like do just go for the thing you're passionate about or the thing you're like, you think if you're brand new to Black Powder gaming, then, you know, maybe you're going to have to figure out like where you want to start. So if or, in doubt, Napoleonics is always fine, but
yeah, because that is probably the most accessible, right? Napoleonics. So maybe it's even a factor of what miniatures can I buy?
Yeah, Napoleonics, obviously, are super well covered by, like, the Perry stuff or, like, 172 scale. You can get stuff for cheap, or you can get stuff that looks good. That's kind of your two choices. but, yeah, like, look at, you know, like, I forget, there's obviously more American Civil War stuff stateside, but there are definitely some UK companies as well. If you want Franco-Prussian War, maybe that's a little more specific to certain companies. So you can take a look at like what's available. You can also just go look at like companies that do historical miniatures to see like what catches your eye. Like I've seen more than a few people who got into Napoleonic Wargaming because they looked like the AB miniatures, like range of figures.
Oh yeah.
And you just kind of fall in love with those or like see what catches your eye. Some people want to play like a conflict with their country that they live in or were born in. We're part of like you know, like if you had a family member who was like in a regiment in like the Napoleonic Wars, maybe that's if you know your family history, like it could be anything literally, but whatever you're interested in and passionate about, that's where you should start.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's a good wrap up for this. We will have a link to download below. You have to pay money, of course. It's going to be on War Game Vault. And yeah, just click the little link below and you will be directed right to the page where you can give Ivan all your money and you can enjoy some great musket and rifle fun.
Yes, and like RogueCammer, it will be updated in response to feedback. So especially for things like the scenarios and stuff like that, we're hoping to update those. As and there's always the inevitable like post-release bugs that just slipped everyone's eyeballs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so expect a living rulebook from here on in, I would say.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. With many versions to come.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And so that wraps up our podcast for our topics at the very least. So
yeah,
I'm going to release the two videos when I have a little bit of time. I'm going to chop them up. So there'll be a breakdown on just RogueCammer and just Musket to Rifle for people to reference later on.
Yeah. So if you're just here for one of them, then you can.
Or if you want to share the game with someone else, then just wait for those videos to come out and then they'll have a better direct reference to.
Yeah,
the game itself. And I think the AI questions worked out all right for a good kind of meaty overview of the game.
Yeah, they were actually better than I thought. You had sent them over and I kind of looked at them, but I didn't read them that closely because I didn't want to like over-prepare like answers.
Okay, yeah.
I think they worked pretty well. You could definitely tell some of them there's like that certain cadence of trying to be like overly educational.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, certain words AI uses that other people do not.
Yes. all right. Oh, Jason is saying in the chat that it's Hearts time.
Oh, Hearts time. And Don Juan Don says, thanks for the great discussion.
Thank you.
Riga had popped in and said, had listed, do you mean all those Black Powder era movies lied to me?
Literally all of them, except sort of the 70s Waterloo movie. That one's pretty right.
Hmm. The rest what about of them... Sharp's Practice? Are they a bunch of liars?
What's that?
Sharp's Practice, a bunch of liars.
I don't want to say that they are.
Because you'll offend so many fans.
Yes, and I do like those movies, but with those, you kind of get the opposite effect where you see like eight guys and they're supposed to stand in for like a battalion. But you zoom in the camera like real close. You can't see they're standing in like an empty field. There's nothing going on. But, you know, Sharp's Practice has probably created more Napoleonic gamers than, like, literally anything else. So just, have fun. The books are actually pretty good, too. If you want to chill with some light adventure fiction, they're quite fun.
Nice. And the Peachy
Batman. It's hard to resist Sean Bean.
Yeah. That's true. I was going to say, the Peachy Bat reps all featuring Sharp's Practice are amazingly entertaining. And I could definitely see him incorporating this game into it as well. So maybe we need to put a little bug in his ear.
Yeah, it could be.
Okay, so I guess it's Heart Attack time.
Yeah.
All right, everyone, thanks for watching. Big old hearts for you. And goodbye.
This episode of Bad Internet Friends was streamed live on YouTube and Twitch. There is a North American friendly live stream every second Wednesday of the month, and a European friendly live stream every fourth Monday of the month.